tried to kill her. An absurd tale that the mirror was Old Stone Age. A man inside the mirror whom she'd freed, allegedly a ruthless killer. Insane events. Face buried in her palms, she whimpered, "What's happening to me?" But she knew what was happening to her. It was painfully obvious. She was losing it, that was what. And she wouldn't be the first graduate student to crack under the strain of an overly ambitious load. Hardly a term passed without one or two dropping out of the program. The survivors always shook their heads and gossiped mercilessly about how so-and-so just couldn't take the pressure. She knew. She'd been among them.
"But I can take the pressure. I'm doing great. Look at my GPA."
She protested inwardly.
"Right, uh-huh,"
logic countered flatly.
"So what other explanation is there for the crazy hallucinations or dreams or whatever they are that you've been suffering for the past few days?"
She sighed. There was no denying it. In the past few days, she'd had two distinct bouts of, well, something, during which she'd not only been incapable of distinguishing reality from fantasy, she'd not even been in charge of her own fantasy. Which hardly seemed fair, she thought, biting back a bubble of near-hysterical laughter. If a girl was going to lose her mind, shouldn't she at least get to enjoy it? Why on earth would she conjure the perfect male specimen, the most incendiary of hotties, then make herself the hapless victim of some bizarre murder plot?
"I just don't get it."
Gingerly, she rubbed the pads of her index fingers in small circles on her throbbing temples. Unless it had actually happened.
Right. Uh-huh.
A man in a mirror. Sure. Still holding her temples, she raised her head, peering about the dimly lit office seeking clues. There was no indication that anyone but she had ever been there. Oh, the lamp was on the floor rather than on its usual perch on the table, and a book was lying on the rug near the wall. But neither of those things could be construed as conclusive evidence that someone else had been in the office with her last night. People were known to sleepwalk in the midst of highly vivid dreams. She forced herself to look in the mirror, directly into it. Hard, silvered glass. Nothing more. Forced herself to stand up, walk over to it, place her cold palms against the colder glass. Hard, silvered glass. Nothing more. No way anything had come out of that. Squaring her shoulders, she turned her back on the relic. Moving stiffly, she retrieved her backpack from the floor, scooped up the books the professor wanted, stuffed them into her bag, let herself out, and locked up the office. For the first time in the entire history of her academic career, Jessie did the unthinkable. She ditched classes, went home, took some aspirin, tugged on her favorite Godsmack t-shirt, crawled into bed, pulled the covers up over her head, and hid. She never gave up. Never abandoned her plans and schedule. Never failed to meet things head on. As tight as her schedule was, if she let a single thing slip or fall behind, a dozen others were affected. One tiny lapse could initiate a wildly entropic downward spiral. Ergo, everything had to be tackled and completed as planned. Last winter, she'd trudged to class in the middle of one of Chicago's most brutal snowstorms, trembling from head to toe with violent flu chills, so sick that all the millions of tiny pores in her skin stung like little needle pricks. She'd lectured on more than one occasion while bordering on laryngitis, forcing her voice only with the aid of a disgustingly vile tea of orange peel, olive oil, and varied unmentionables she still shuddered to think about. She'd graded papers with a fever of 102. But craziness wasn't something one could tackle and complete, moving on to the next project. And she had no clue how to deal with it. Figuring chocolate was a start, as soon as she stepped through the door of her apartment, she grabbed a bag of Hershey's Kisses she kept stashed away for emergencies, i.e. bad hair, severe PMS, or just one of those good old men are stupid and suck days, and in her warm cocoon beneath the blankets, began making short work of the decadent, melty little morsels. After devouring the entire bag, she fell asleep. She slept straight through until 9 o'clock that night. Upon awakening, She felt so much better that it occurred to her perhaps all she'd really needed was a good, solid 10 hours of uninterrupted sleep. That perhaps, now that she was getting older, after all, she wasn't a freshman anymore, she was 24 years old. Her frequent all-nighters exacted more of a toll than they used to. That perhaps she should start taking vitamins, drink more milk, eat her vegetables. She wasn't crazy, she thought, shaking her head and smiling faintly at the sheer absurdity of the notion. Those two intensely vivid dream hallucinations she'd suffered had been merely an isolated occurrence of stress, coupled with lack of sleep, and she was making a big deal out of nothing.
I was just exhausted, she told herself with a perfunctory, optimistic little nod.
Chocolate and sleep had buoyed her spirits, fortified her to begin anew. She was ready to start all over again, to face the day or night, as it may be, and prove to herself that there was nothing wrong with her. At least, that was how she felt before she turned on the TV. Vengeance. 'Twas the possibility that had kept Kian McKelter from going stark raving mad during the past 1,133 years of his incarceration in the dark glass. From without, the glass looked to be little more than an elaborate mirror. From within, it was a circular stone prison, 15 paces across at any point one chose to walk it. And he'd walked it a lot, counted every bloody stone, stone floor, stone walls, stone ceiling. Gray, drab, cold. He'd stayed heated over the centuries by one thought only, burning like liquid fire in his veins. Vengeance. He'd lived it, breathed it, become it. Caged and waiting, ever since the day Lucan Merthyn Trevane, a man he'd once counted as his closest friend and boon companion in the arts, had bound him to the dark glass, thereby securing immortality for himself. Given the extent of the binding spells Lucan had used on him, coupled with his powerlessness within the glass and his inability to exit it, unless granted a brief freedom by the chanting of a summoning spell by someone beyond it, some might have dismissed his hope for vengeance as an impossibility. But being a druid, and a Keltar at that, Kian understood things that seemed impossible rarely were. What impossible truly meant was, hasn't happened yet. A fact that had been demonstrated well enough when, 3.5 months ago, a thief had broken into Trevane's London stronghold, an impossibility in itself, and carted off half the bastard's most prized relics, including the dark glass, scant months before the tithe that bound Kian to the Hallow was due. Chance had favored him at long last. Lucan had lost possession of the mirror just when he needed it the most. Now it was the 10th day of the 10th month, and Kian need only stay out of Lucan's hands for a mere 22 more days, until just after midnight on All Hallows' Eve, the anniversary of his original binding, in order to satisfy his millennium-old lust for vengeance. And bloody hell, he was starved for it. Now that Lucan had a solid lead on the Dark Book, the most dangerous of all the Unseelie Hallows, it was even more critical that Kian shatter the cursed compact imprisoning him. Fulcrum for some of the deadliest black magic known to man, the Dark Book in the hands of any man was a recipe for cataclysmic destruction. In the hands of Lucan Merlin Trevane, it could brew the end of the world as the world knew it. Lucan could rewrite history, change time itself, if he managed to decipher some of the intricate spells therein. Kian had to stop him from getting the book. He had to defeat his ancient enemy once and for all. He'd thought success within his grasp, had believed given how many hands the dark glass had been passed through, and how far it had been sent, that Lucan would never find it in time. But yesterday had illustrated otherwise. He'd indeed been found, and his time had run out. He'd recognized the Russian assassin the moment he'd slipped into the office last eve. He'd glimpsed him several times in the past when Roman had visited Trevane's London residence, where Kian had hung high on a wall in Lucan's private study, being taunted by a view out a wall of windows that overlooked a busy London street, in a world in which he would never live again. At least he'd had a view. Had Lucan hung him toward the wall, he wasn't certain even lust for vengeance would have kept him sane. Nor would it have afforded him the opportunity to test the mirror when his jailer was away, and learn to summon in inert objects that were within his line of vision. In such a fashion, he'd kept up with time's fierce trot forward, devouring every book, periodical, and newspaper that passed through Lucan's study over the centuries, occasionally even seeing a bit of television. While his view beyond the window metamorphosed from a sweetly rolling meadow to a small town, and finally to a sophisticated, bustling city. Much like this Chicago in which he'd walked last eve. Free. Sweet Christ, he'd walked free again for a time. He'd felt the crush of grass beneath his boots, savored the wind in his face. There were days inside the mirror when he felt he might willingly cut off his right arm for a single deep breath of a peat fire, heaped with sheaves of fragrant heather, or a few lungfuls of briny air on Scotia's wild shore, or to sprawl on his back atop a high ben, as close to the heavens as one could get only in the Highlands, and watch the gloaming take the sky, streak and smudge it with violet and crimson, then turn it to a black velvet canopy sprinkled with starry diamonds. He'd not seen his beloved Scotia in 1133 years. That was hell right there for a Highlander, to live exiled from his motherland. Though Lucan had occasionally granted him freedoms in exchange for aid with a particularly difficult spell or a dark deed he wanted done, the bastard had stayed on intricately warded ground the entire time, so Kian couldn't touch him. The last had been over 120 years ago, and such freedoms were agonizingly brief. The dark glass's magic always reclaimed him after a time, despite his resistance. It didn't matter how fast or far from it he fled. Didn't matter what druid wards he wove about himself. After a time, and it was never the same interval, once an entire day, another time no more than a single hour, he was simply no longer wherever he'd been. One moment free, the next back in his prison. It had taken him some time last night to track Roman, and because he'd been concerned the mirror might reclaim him before he succeeded, he'd focused single-mindedly on the task. He had no doubt another of Lucan's men would soon be coming, and another, ad infinitum until the mirror had been collected and all trace of any who'd so much as glimpsed it eradicated. It was the way of men of their ilk, men of magics, light and dark. Those who practiced Dreilhecht, to conceal such things as the hallows from the world. Kian, because common man should not be troubled by the existence of such things. Lucan, because there were many other sorcerers out there, scrupulously staying off one another's radar, who would stop at nothing to steal the coveted, dangerous, dark hallows, were they to learn he had them. Contrary to what many thought, sorcerers and witches were a flourishing breed. A Keltar druid would have worked a complex memory spell to harmlessly, if properly and painstakingly done, erase the forbidden knowledge from the minds of any who'd encountered it. But not Lucan. Simpler to kill. Minimum effort, maximum pleasure and gain. Lucan thrived on power over life and death. He always had. Kian smiled bitterly. Anyone in his path was expendable, and the woman was in his path. She was in mortal danger that she couldn't possibly begin to fathom or hope to survive. His thoughts both gentled and grew fiercer as they turned toward her. Fiery, determined, courageous, she was a stunning woman, with short, glossy black hair curling softly back from a heart-shaped, delicate-featured face, and the most perfect, bountiful, lusciously rounded breasts he'd ever seen. A delectable ass, too. He'd seen in great detail each intimate curve in her low-slung blue jeans and snug peach sweater. He'd even glimpsed part of her panties, which couldn't have covered more than a fraction of her generous bottom, fashioned as they were from little more than ribbons, peeking up from the waistband of her jeans. The orange, lacy stuff had been adorned by a bright pink butterfly at the base of her spine, making it seem her panties had been designed to slide up from her jeans to taunt a man's eye. Men must be paragons of restraint in this century, he'd thought, staring fixedly at the scrap of frothy fabric rising from between the twin globes of her ass. Or a bunch of bloody eunuchs. Creamy, sun-kissed skin. Eyes of jade. Mouth of a temptress. Lucan's assassin had called her Jessica. As Kian had anticipated, she'd endeavored to convince herself that none of last eve had happened. On those infrequent occasions he'd been glimpsed by the uninitiated, they blamed everything and anything to deny the possibility of his existence. He, on the other hand, would replay over and over a single moment from last eve, convincing himself it had indeed happened. She'd rubbed up against him and tasted him, crushed those round, heavy breasts to his back, nipples hard and poking him through the fabric of her woolen, and licked him, as if she'd hungered for the salt of his skin on her tongue. His cock had shot up so painfully erect that his balls had jerked, and his seed had nearly exploded out of him right then and there. The feel of her against his body had caused a thing he'd never before experienced, a violent jolt that had speared straight to the core of his soul. It had been all he could do to force her hands from his hair and pull away. It had taken every ounce of his will not to simply turn on her, drop her to the floor, and spread her for his pleasure. Forget about her assailant entirely. Bury himself inside her and stay there until torn from her body by dark magic. But nay, not only wouldn't he let her life be snuffed like some frail candle flame caught in a deadly tempest not of her own making. He needed her. 22 days, he murmured. After more than a millennium of biding time, his vengeance was now dependent upon a laughably finite number of days. Jessica St. James didn't know it yet, but she was going to help him get them. If not willingly, then by means of every dark art he knew. And he knew a lot of them. Had practiced most of them, and excelled at all of them. Lucan wasn't the only one who'd wanted the dark glass. Chapter 4. Castle Keltar, Scotland.
"You'll ne'er believe this, Drustan,"
Dagus McKelter said, glancing up as his twin brother, elder by 3 minutes, strolled into the library at Castle Keltar.
"I dunna think much would surprise me after all we've seen, brother, but try me,"
Drustan said dryly. He crossed to a handsome mahogany serving bar, artfully crafted into a section of bookshelves, and poured himself a tumbler of Macallan, fine, aged, single malt scotch. Dagus flipped through a few more pages of the scuffed leather tome he held, then placed it aside and stretched out his legs, folding his hands behind his head. Beyond tall, velvet-draped windows, violet smudged a cobalt sky, and he paused a moment, savoring the beauty of yet another highland gloaming. Then,
"You know how we've ever thought Kian McKelter not more than a myth?"
"Aye," Drustan replied, moving to join him near the fire. "The legendary and terrible Kian. The only Keltar ancestor to ever willingly cross over to the dark arts."
"Not quite true, brother. So did I,"
Dagus corrected softly. Drustan stiffened.
"Nay, you acted out of love. 'Twas a vastly different thing. This Kian, who, like as not, is pure fable crafted to reinforce our adherence to our oaths, did so out of unquenchable lust for power."
"Mayhap. Mayhap not."
Cynicism shaped the edges of Dagus's smile.
"I would place no wagers on what our progeny might say of me 1,000 years hence."
He gestured to the tome.
"'Tis one of Kian McKelter's journals."
Drustan stopped, halfway down into a chair, tumbler nearly to his lips. Silvery eyes, glittering with fascination, met his twin's golden gaze. He lowered his glass, sank slowly into the chair.
"Indeed."
"Aye, though a great many pages have been torn out, the notations were made by one Kian McKelter, who lived in the mid-ninth century."
Is that the journal you said Dorr found in the hidden underground chamber library? Last you went through the stones with Chloe to the 16th century.
The hidden underground library was the long, narrow chamber hewn of stone that stretched deep beneath the castle, wherein the vast majority of Keltar lore and relics, including the gold compact struck between Tuatha De Danann and man, were housed. It had been sealed up, the entrance concealed behind a hearth, more than a millennium ago. Over time, the existence of the chamber had been completely forgotten. Vague tales that once the Keltar had possessed much more in the way of lore existed, but few believed, and fewer still had searched for it, and those to no avail. It wasn't until the castle housekeeper, Nell, who'd later wed their Da, Sylvan, and become their next mother, had inadvertently triggered the opening mechanism while dusting one day, that it had been found again. Still, she'd said naught about it, believing Sylvan knew, and would be upset if she had knowledge of his clan's private doings. She would likely never have mentioned it to Sylvan had Dagus not been in such desperate straits. Their Da had briefly opened that chamber in the 16th century, but had resealed it in hopes of not altering events that had already transpired between the 16th and 21st centuries. Drustin had recently agreed to make it again accessible for future generations. Since reopening it, Dagus had been translating the most ancient of the scrolls therein, recopying the fragile documents, and learning much more about their ancient benefactors in the process. And now, about one of their ancient ancestors.
Nay, that journal was but a record of recent events, handfastings, births, deaths. This journal deals with his studies into the Druid arts, much of it in cipher. 'Twas hidden beneath a cracked flagstone o'er which Chloe tripped. She suspects there may be more concealed about the chamber.
Dagus's wife, Chloe, an avid historian, had set her heart on systematically cataloging the contents of the underground repository, and as Dagus couldn't bear to be parted from her for any length of time, he'd resigned himself to spending a great deal of time, meaning probably until the very moment his lovely pregnant wife was about to deliver, in the dusty subterranean compartment. Hence the scribing task he'd assigned himself. He smiled. Better a dank chamber with his cherished Chloe than the sunniest highland vista without her.
Och, he amended fiercely. Better hell with Chloe than heaven without her.
Such was the depth of his love for the woman whom he'd taken captive in his darkest hour, who'd pledged her heart to him despite his actions, despite the evil within him.
"So, what does it tell us of this ancestor of ours?"
Drustin said curiously, jarring him from his thoughts. Dagus snorted, disgruntled. He'd hoped for much more, and planned to dig deeper in the chamber to see what else he could uncover about their epic ancestor. He believed an understanding of the past was necessary to ensure a bright future, that those who forgot the past were condemned to repeat it.
"From the parts I've managed to decipher, little more than that he was, in truth, a man, not a fable, and that the chamber was not forgotten, but deliberately hidden from us. Da believed there had been a battle or illness that had taken many lives abruptly, including all those who knew of the chamber. But 'twas not the case. The final entry in the journal is not his, but a warning about the use of magics. Whoever made the entry also made the decision to seal the chamber, altering the rooms above to forever conceal it.
Indeed.
Drustin's brows rose.
Aye, so many pages have been torn out, I dunna ken what Cian MacElter did that was so terrible, or what became his fate. But the last entry makes it plain that the chamber was secreted away because of him.
Drustin mused, sipping his scotch. It makes one wonder what a man might have done to cause such drastic measures to be taken. The separating of all future generations of Keltar from the bulk of our knowledge and power. 'Twas no small thing to divide us from our heritage.
Aye, Dagus said thoughtfully. Indeed, it does make one wonder.
Can you friggin' believe it, man? Somebody broke the guy's neck and left him there on the commons, dead as a doornail.
Great. That's just what we need, more crime. The university'll use it as another excuse to put the screws to us and raise tuition again.
Jessie shook her head, pushed her way through the group of undergrads loitering at the coffee bar. As she placed her order, she wondered if she'd ever been so young, or so faux-jaded. She hoped not. Campus was abuzz with gossip. The police had released few details, so everyone was pretending to know something. Funny thing was, she really did know something about the blonde, well-dressed John Doe found dead on the campus commons yesterday, and she was the only one not talking. And she wasn't about to. When she'd flipped on the TV last night, only to discover the local news featuring a story on the murder of one of the two men she'd spent most of the day convincing herself weren't real, she'd sat, stunned, staring blankly at the screen long after the segment had ended. The police were investigating the blonde man's murder. He'd carried no identification, and they'd issued a statement asking anyone who might know something about him to come forward. All of which begged the questions, if the rest of the world could see the blonde man too, did that mean she wasn't crazy? Or did it mean that the blonde man was real, but she'd still hallucinated the man in the mirror and accompanying events? Or did it mean she was so far gone crazy that now she was hallucinating news programs in a sick, though, if she had to say so herself, admirably determined and impressively cohesive effort to lend credibility to her delusions? Ugh. Tough questions. She'd mulled over such convoluted thoughts for hours until finally, in the wee hours of dawn, she'd achieved a measure of calm via a firm resolution. She would approach her current predicament the same way she would approach an archaeological inquiry, by applying the meticulous methods of a scientific analyst. She would gather all the facts she could, and only when she had everything she could dig up would she endeavor to piece the facts together into the most accurate representation of reality she could achieve with them. There would be no further talk of crazy, nor thoughts of it, until she'd completed her investigation. Critical to her investigation, a talk with Professor Keene, she needed to ask him questions about the relic she'd come to wish she'd never laid eyes on. Like, where the heck had it come from? Maybe it wasn't a relic at all, she thought, briefly buoyed by the possibility. But a gag relic of some kind. A special effects prop from a Stargate episode or some other Sci-Fi Channel program. And maybe it had state-of-the-art, highly technical, cleverly hidden audio-visual feeds hooked into it somehow. And it all powered some really tiny, extraordinarily sophisticated projection screen system, which, didn't exactly explain the interaction between attacker and man in the mirror, but hey, she was just working up possibilities, devising and discarding. Possibility. Maybe it was, cursed. That thought made her feel inordinately foolish. Didn't sit well with her inner analyst. Still, better foolish than mad as a mirror maker. She'd phoned the professor last night, using the direct line to his room that he'd left her in one of his gazillion messages, but he'd not answered. She'd tried again first thing this morning, but no luck. Still sleeping, she supposed. Bottom line, she was a pragmatist. She'd not gotten this far in her life by being illogical or prone to whimsy. She was a what-I've-got-in-my-hand kind of girl. And after intense reflection, she decided that she didn't feel crazy. She felt perfectly normal about everything, except for this idiotic ongoing mirror incident. Maybe she should smash it, she thought peevishly. End of problems, right? Except, not necessarily. If she was crazy, her illusory sex god would probably just take up residence in some other inanimate object. That certainly brought to mind a few intriguing ideas, especially something in her bedside table drawer. If she wasn't crazy, she could conceivably be destroying one of the most pivotal, dogma-shattering relics in recent human history. Looks like I'm stuck fact-finding. She puffed out an irritated little sigh. Rummaging in her pack for her cell phone, she withdrew it, flipped it open, and glanced down at the screen. No messages. She'd been hoping the professor would call her back before she got tied up in classes all day. Too late now. She turned off the phone, tucked it back in her bag, grabbed her coffee from the counter, paid the cashier, and hurried off. She had classes back to back until 4:45 p.m., but the second she was done, she was heading straight to the hospital. 5:52 p.m. The Dan Ryan Expressway at rush hour was a level in Dante's hell. Jesse was hopelessly gridlocked in stop-and-go traffic that was way more stop than go. So much stop, in fact, that she'd been working on homework for the past half hour, when her cell phone rang. She tossed aside the notes she'd been taking, crept forward a celebration-worthy 18 inches, whipped out her phone and answered, hoping it was the professor. But it was Mark Trudeau. The statement was just forming on her tongue that there was no way she was taking on even one more paper to grade when he ripped all the words right out of her mouth by telling her he was calling to let her know the campus police had just informed him that Professor Keene was dead. She started shaking, clenched the steering wheel, and exhaled a sob.
"And get this, Jess, he was murdered,"
Mark relayed in an excited rush, clearly fascinated and clearly oblivious to the fact that she was crying, despite the wet, snuffling sounds she was making. Men could be so dense sometimes. Dimly, she realized traffic was creeping forward again, eased her foot off the clutch, dragged the sleeve of her jacket across her face.
"The cops are talking like he got mixed up in something bad, Jess. Said he recently pulled a lot of money out of his retirement and mortgaged his house big time. I guess he owns some land somewhere in Georgia that he sold, too. Cops have no idea what he suddenly needed so much money for."
Belatedly realizing the car in front of her had stopped again, she hit the brakes and came to an abrupt halt a bare inch behind the rear bumper of the car in front of her. The guy behind her honked angrily. Not just once, but laid on it, complete with assorted hand gestures.
"Right,"
she snapped through tears, making a gesture of her own in the rearview mirror.
"Like it's my fault traffic stopped moving again. Get over it!"
Traffic was the least of her concerns. She closed her eyes. The cops might not know why the professor had needed the money, but she did. It would seem the mirror was a bona fide relic after all, albeit one that had come, she was now willing to bet serious money, hot off the black market. The professor had indeed gotten mixed up in something bad.
"Garroted,"
Mark was saying.
"He was actually garroted. Nobody does that anymore, do they? Who does that kind of thing?"
She palmed the microphone on her cell, stared unseeingly out at the sea of stopped cars.
"What on earth is going on?"
she half-whispered. Mark continued talking, a distant, chafing din.
"The professor and I have already had our time together this evening,"
the blonde man had said. And she'd pushed the comment brusquely aside, too wrapped up in her own petty concerns and interests. And now the professor was dead. Correction, she thought, a little chill seeping into her bones. According to what Mark had just told her, time of death 6:15 p.m. Monday. He'd been dead before she'd even gone to pick up his books that night. The whole time she'd been standing in his office, he'd been dead.
"And get this,"
said Mark, still blathering away.
"Ellis, the department head, tells me I'm going to have to take the professor's classes for the rest of the term. Can you believe this shit? Like they can't afford to hire..."
"Oh, grow up, Mark,"
Jesse hissed, thumbing the off button. When finally she managed to escape the 10th level of hell, Jesse made a beeline for side streets and headed straight back to campus. Thoughts tumbled in disjointed confusion through her mind. Amid them all was a single clear one, drawing her like a beacon. She had to see the mirror again. Why? She had no idea. It was simply the only thing she could think of to do. She couldn't bring herself to go home. In her current state of mind, she would climb the walls. She couldn't go to the hospital. There was no longer anyone to visit. She had a few close friends, but they tended to work as much as she, so dropping by unexpectedly wasn't the coolest thing to do. And besides, even if she did, what would she say?
"Hi, Ginger, how have you been? By the way, either I've gone insane, or my life has taken on distinct shades of Indiana Jones, complete with mysterious relics, foreign villains, and spectacular audiovisual special effects."
When she got back to the office, there was police tape across the door. That stopped her for a moment. Then she noticed it was campus police tape and tugged it aside. Violating university procedures didn't seem quite as felonious a felony as breaking a law in the real world. As she jiggled the key in the lock, making sure it really was locked this time, she asked herself just what she thought she was going to do once she was inside. Strike up a conversation with a relic? Lay her hands on the glass, try to summon a spirit. Make like it was a Ouija board or something. As fate would have it, she didn't have to do a thing. Because the moment she opened the door, a shaft of light splintered in from the hallway, straight onto the silvery glass. Her feet froze. Her hands clenched on the door. Even her breath stopped mid-inhalation. She wasn't certain, but she fancied her heart paused a long, ponderous moment as well. The towering, half-naked, absolute sex god of a man standing inside the mirror, glaring out at her, snarled,
"'Tis high damn time you came back, wench!"
Chapter 5. When Jessie was 17 years old, she'd almost died. She'd gone to one of those indoor rock-climbing gyms because her best friend had called to tell her that the football player she had a crush on was home from college that weekend, and he and his friends were supposed to be there, and taken a horrible fall, breaking multiple bones and splitting her skull. She'd missed the best parts of her senior year in high school, recuperating at home with her head shaved from where they'd inserted a metal plate to piece her skull back together, listening to other people's stories of proms and parties and graduations. And the guy she'd been so crazy about hadn't even been at the climbing gym that day. She'd learned a few things from the experience. One, the whole best-laid plans of mice and men adage was absolutely true. She'd not gotten to rally her football team to the state finals the only year they'd made it in the past 7. She'd not gotten to wear the scrumptious pink prom dress that still hung in her closet. She'd not tossed her cap. She'd not attended a single senior party. And two, sometimes when things got bad, a sense of humor was a person's only saving grace. You could either laugh or you could cry. And crying not only made you feel worse, it made you look worse, too. It occurred to her as she stood there, staring at the thing in the mirror that couldn't possibly be in the mirror, in a room where a recent attempt on her life had been made, said room's previous occupant having been murdered recently himself, that events of the past few days certainly qualified as bad, even by conservative standards. She started to giggle. She couldn't help it. The sex god's dark eyes narrowed and he scowled.
"'Tis no laughing matter. Get in here and close that door, now. There is much of which we must speak, and time is of the veriest essence."
She giggled harder, one hand to her mouth, the other clutching the door jamb. Time is of the veriest essence. Who talked like that?
"For the love of Christ, wench, summon me out,"
he said, sounding exasperated.
"Someone needs to shake you."
"Oh, I don't think so,"
she managed between giggles, giggles that were starting to sound just a tiny bit hysterical.
"And I am not a wench,"
she informed him loftily, and giggled. He growled softly.
"Woman, you summoned me out the other eve, and I did you no harm. Will you not trust me again?"
She snickered.
"I thought I was sound asleep and dreaming the other night. It had nothing to do with trust."
"I killed the man who was trying to kill you. Is that not reason enough to trust me?"
She stopped laughing. There it was. He was the one who'd snapped the blonde man's neck and left him lying dead on the commons. Though a part of her brain knew it had to have been him, whether such events had transpired in a delusional world or the real one, his remark drew her gaze to his hands. Big hands. Neck-snapping hands. After a moment's hesitation, she stepped warily into the office. Another pause. Then she slowly closed the door behind her. The giggles were gone. A thousand questions were not. Jamming her hands into the front pockets of her jeans, she stared at the mirror. She closed her eyes, squeezed them shut hard, opened them, tried it twice more for good measure. He was still there. Oh, shit.
"I could have told you that wouldn't work,"
he said dryly.
"Am I crazy?"
she whispered.
"Hey, you're not daft. I am here, This is indeed happening, and if you wish to survive, you must credit what I tell you.
People can't be inside mirrors. It's not possible.
Tell that to the mirror.
He thumped his fists against the inside of the glass for emphasis.
Funny, but not convincing.
Oh, that was weird, seeing him pound on the mirror from the inside.
You must resolve your own mind on the matter. Best do so before another comes to kill you.
His blasé response argued his case to her. Said he knew he was real, and if she was too dense to figure it out, it wasn't his problem. Surely a delusion would endeavor to self-persist, wouldn't it? But how could he be real? She had no precedent for dealing with the inexplicable.
Fact-finding. All I can do is explore what's happening and reserve judgment until I know more.
Toward that end, shedding light on things, she reached for the wall switch and flipped on the overhead, and got her first truly good look at him.
Criminy,
she thought, eyes widening as if to drink in even more of him. The two prior times she'd caught glimpses of him, they'd been briefly snatched, and the room had been heavily shadowed. She'd absorbed only a general impression of him, a big, dark, intensely sexual man. She'd not seen the details. And what details they were! Stunned, she looked down. Up. Down. Up again. Slowly.
Take your time, lass,
he murmured, so softly she scarcely heard him. His next comment was deliberately beyond her audible range, a silky,
I plan to with you.
He was tall, stuffing the mirror from top to bottom of frame, powerfully built, with wide shoulders and rippling muscles. He wore a fabric of crimson and black around his waist, an honest-to-God kilt, if she wasn't mistaken, glittering metallic wrist cuffs and black leather boots. No shirt. Wicked-looking black and crimson tattooed runes covered the left side of his sculpted chest, from the bottom of his ribcage, up over a nipple, across his shoulder, and to the edge of his jaw. Each powerful biceps was also encircled by a band of tattooed crimson and black runes. A thick, silky trail of dark hair began just above the navel on his ripped abs, slid down into the plaid. Oh God, was it tinting? Was that a bulge lifting the tartan? Her gaze got stuck there for an awkward moment. Her eyes widened even farther. Sucking in a shallow breath, she jerked her gaze away. A flush heated her cheeks. She'd just ogled his penis, stood there blatantly eyeing it, long enough that he had to have noticed. Something was just not right with her. Her hormones had somehow gotten seriously out of whack. She was an artifact ogler, not a penis ogler. She forced her gaze up to his face. It was as sinfully gorgeous as the rest of him. He had the chiseled, proud features of an ancient Celt warrior, strong jaw and cheekbones, a straight, aristocratic nose flaring arrogantly at the nostrils, and a mouth so sexy and kissable that her own lips instinctively puckered, then parted just looking at it, as if sampling a kiss. She wet them, feeling strangely breathless. Dark shadow stubbled his sculpted jaw, making his firm pink lips seem even more sexual against all that rough masculinity. His hair wasn't black, as she'd thought in the dark, but a rich, gleaming mahogany, shot with shimmering strands of gold and copper. Half of it was caught in dozens of narrow braids, banded at the ends with glittering metallic beadwork. His eyes were burnt whiskey, his skin tawny velvet. He dripped primeval, elemental power, looked as much a relic as the mirror itself, a throwback to a time when men had been men and women had done as they were told. Her eyes narrowed. She couldn't stand men like that, chauvinistic, domineering men who thought they could order women around. Too bad her body didn't seem to be of the same mind. Too bad her body seemed downright intrigued by the various orders possible, like, take off your clothes, woman. Let me get the taste of you on the back of my tongue. It didn't help that he looked like the kind of man who wouldn't take no for an answer, who would tolerate zero inhibitions on a woman's part, the kind of man that, once he got a woman in bed, didn't let her out again until he'd done everything there was to do to her. Had fucked her so thoroughly that she could barely walk.
"Summon me out, woman,"
came the tight, low command laced by that sexy Scots burr. His voice was as incredible as his appearance. Deep and rich as hot, dark, buttered rum, it slid down into her belly, pooling there in a slow burn.
"No,"
she said faintly. No way she was letting all that, whatever it was, too much testosterone by far, out again.
"Then I bid you, woman, cease looking at me like that."
"Like what?"
she bristled.
"Like you wish to be using your tongue on me again, and on more than my back."
He caught his lower lip between his teeth and flashed her a devilish smile.
"I didn't mean to lick you,"
she snapped defensively.
"I told you I thought you were a dream."
"Any dream you wish, woman. You need but summon me out."
His gaze raked over her, burning hot, lingering at her breasts and thighs. Heat suffused her skin where his gaze skimmed.
"Not going to happen."
He shrugged, powerful shoulders bunching and rippling.
"Have it your way, wench. Die needlessly. Don't say I didn't offer my aid."
He turned in the mirror then. The silver encasing him seemed to ripple. The black stain around the edges flowed and ebbed as if the surface were suddenly liquid. Then she was beholding a mere looking glass.
"Hey, wait!"
she cried, panicking.
"Get back here!"
She needed answers. She needed to know what was going on. What the mirror was, how any of this was even happening. Who was trying to kill her? Would there really be more assassins sent after her?
"Why?"
His deep butter-rum voice resonated from somewhere within the glass.
"Because I need to know what's going on."
"Not in this world is free, woman."
"What are you saying?"
she asked the smooth silver surface. She was conversing with a mirror. Alice in Wonderland had nothing on her.
"'Tis plain enough, isn't it? I have something you need. You have something I want."
She went absolutely still. Her breath caught in the back of her throat, and her heart began to hammer. She moistened suddenly parched lips.
What?
"You need my protection. You need me to keep you alive. I ken what's going on, who's coming after you, and how to stop them."
"And what do you want in return?"
she asked warily.
"Hark. Myriad things, lass. But we'll keep it simple and start with freedom."
She shook her head.
"Uh-uh. No way. I don't know the first..."
"You know all you need to know."
He cut her off flatly.
"You know you'll die without me. Think not to constrain me. I've been stuck in this bloody friggin' mirror far too long for civility. This glass is the only prison I'll suffer. I'll not be allowing ye to be building another for me, woman."
His brogue thickening, he spat the final words. She swallowed. Audibly. Her mouth had gone so dry that she heard tiny things crunch as her Adam's apple rose and fell. She cleared her throat. Suddenly, there he was in the mirror again, looking at her, silver rippling like diamond-spiked water around him. That sexy, arrogant mouth curved in a smile. If he'd meant it to be reassuring, she thought, shivering, he'd missed the mark by a mile. It was a smile full of leashed power and chained heat. Barely leashed. Barely chained. It occurred to her then that, had she gotten a good look at him the other night, she would probably never have released him, whether she'd believed herself to be dreaming or not. The killer she'd thought so terrifying was no match for this man. They weren't even remotely in the same league. Breaking the blonde man's neck had probably been as easy for him as absently swatting a fly. Whatever he was, he had something more. Something normal people just didn't have. She fumbled behind her for the doorknob.
"Let me out,"
he said, low and intense.
Say the words. I will be your shield. I will stand between you and all others. 'Tis what you need, and you can it. Do not be a fool, woman.
Shaking her head, she turned the knob.
Will it be nay, then? Prefer you to die over me? Just what is it you fear I might do to you that would be so terrible?
The way his heated gaze was lingering on certain parts of her made quite clear some of the things he was thinking about doing to her, which of course made her think about them too, in great detail. And there she was, wet-pantied again. What on earth was wrong with her? Had her ovaries somehow gotten stuck in a permanent ovulation cycle? Were her eggs firing indiscriminately and constantly, and in some perverse, inversely proportionate fashion, with greater enthusiasm the worse the man seemed for her? Yanking open the door, she backed out into the hall.
I need to think, she muttered.
Think fast, Jessica. You've not much time.
Great, just great. Every freaking body knows my name. With a fierce little scowl, she slammed the door so hard the frame shuddered.
The next one he sends after you may arrive any moment,
came his deep burr through the door.
And will be more sophisticated than the last. Mayhap it will be a woman. Tell me, lass, will you even see death coming?
Jessie gave the door an angry little kick.
Do not venture far. You're going to need me.
She gritted something rude at the door that he shouldn't have been able to hear. But he did. It made him laugh out loud and say,
ha, 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 a physical impossibility, woman. But believe me, most of us asshole men would.
She rolled her eyes and didn't bother locking it this time. As an afterthought, she plucked off the rest of the police tape, balled it up, and stuffed it in her pocket. Maybe she'd get lucky, and somebody'd steal the damned thing and get it out of her hair. Options. 1. Go to police. Tell all and request protection. 2. Get in touch with original delivery company. Ship mirror back. Hope that fixes everything. 3. Flee country. 4. Check self into mental hospital and trust, with lockups and padded walls. They are safer than regular hospitals. Jessie finished the last of her coffee, pushed aside the mug, stared down at her pathetic little list, and sighed. She was still feeling shaky in the pit of her stomach, but compiling her list of options had calmed her a bit and forced her to take a realistic look at a completely surreal situation. 4 was out. It reeked of casting one's fate to the wind, and when all was said and done, if she had to be in a car wreck, she'd prefer to be the one driving when it happened. Control of one's own destiny and all that. 1 was out. The police would laugh her right out of the station if she tried telling them she knew who'd murdered their John Doe. A tall, dark, and broody sex god who was after his freedom, who just happened to be inside a 10,000-year-old plus mirror, who might also be a ruthless criminal that had been, paranormally interred inside said mirror for the, safety of the world? Uh-huh. Wow. Even she thought she was nuts with that one. That left 2 and 3 as potential solutions. The way she figured it, fleeing the country and staying out of it forever, or at least until she was reasonably certain she'd been forgotten about, would cost a whole lot more than trying to ship the thing back, even with the exorbitant price of insurance figured in, and Jessie had to believe that if she just returned the relic, whoever was after it would leave her alone. After all, what was she going to do? Talk about it, for heaven's sake? Tell people about the impossible artifact once it was gone? Totally discredit herself and ruin any chance she might one day have of a promising future in the field of archaeology? As if. Surely she could persuade them of that, whoever they were. Anyone with half a brain would be able to see that she'd never, in an ice age, talk. She glanced around the university cafe. The cushioned wood booths were sparsely populated at this time of night, and no one was sitting near enough to eavesdrop. Pulling out her cell phone, she flipped it open,
dialed info, and got the number for Allied Certified Deliveries, the name she'd seen emblazoned on the side of the delivery truck. At 8:55 p.m., she didn't expect an answer, so when she got one, she sputtered for a moment before managing to convey the purpose of her call, that she'd gotten a package she wanted to return, but she'd not been given a copy of the bill of lading, so she didn't know where to ship it back to. Making no effort to mask her irritation, the woman on the other end informed her that the office was closed for the day, and she'd only answered because she'd been talking to her husband when their call had been dropped, and she thought it was him calling her back.
"Try again tomorrow,"
she said impatiently.
"Wait, please don't hang up,"
Jesse exclaimed, panicking.
"Tomorrow might be too late. I need it picked up first thing in the morning. I've got to return this thing fast."
Silence.
"It was really expensive to ship."
Jesse shot into the silence, hoping money would keep the woman on the line and motivate her to be helpful.
"Probably one of the more expensive deliveries you guys have done. It came from overseas and required special handling."
"You going to pay to reship, or are you trying to stick it to the shipper?"
the woman asked suspiciously.
"I'll pay,"
Jesse said without hesitation, though she loathed the thought of spending money on something she would end up with nothing to show for. At least she'd be alive to pay it off. She had a downright scary amount of credit on her Visa. It never ceased to amaze her how much rope banks were willing to give college students to hang themselves with.
"Got an invoice number?"
"Of course not. I just told you I don't have the bill of lading. Your guys forgot to give me a copy."
"We never forget to give copies of the BOL.
The woman bristled.
"You must have misplaced it."
Jesse sighed.
"Okay, fine, I misplaced it. Regardless, I don't have it."
"Ma'am, we do hundreds of deliveries a week. Without an invoice number, I have no way of knowing what delivery you're talking about."
"Well, you can look it up by last name, can't you?"
"The computers are down for the night. They go offline at 8. You'll have to call back tomorrow."
"It was an unusual delivery,"
Jesse pushed.
"You might remember it. It was a late-night drop, a recent one. I can describe the guys who brought it."
Swiftly, she detailed the pair. There was another long silence. Then,
"Ma'am, those men were murdered over the weekend. Garroted, just like that professor man that's been all over the news. Police won't leave us alone."
A bitter note entered her voice.
"They've been acting like my husband's company had something to do with it. Like we got shady dealings going on or something."
A pause, then,
"What did you say your name was again?"
Feeling like she'd just been kicked in the stomach, Jesse hung up. She didn't go straight to him. She refused to do that. The thought of such a swift show of defeat was too chafing. The past few days had been a study in humility for her. Not a single thing had gone according to anything remotely resembling the Jesse St. James plan for a good life, and she had the bad feeling nothing was going to for quite a while. So she stubbornly toughed it out in the university cafe until 12:30, sipping still more coffee that her frazzled nerves didn't need, savoring what she suspected might be her last moments of near normalcy for a long time, before caving in to the inevitable. She had no desire to die. Criminy, she'd hardly even gotten to live yet. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Her friend Ginger had given her a coffee mug with that quote on it a few months ago. If you spun it around, the other side said, "When did having a life become an event you had to schedule?" She'd stuffed it way in the back of her cupboard and not looked at it again, the sad truth of it shaving too close to the bone. No. She certainly wasn't ready to die. She wanted at least another 60 or 70 years. She hadn't even gotten to the good parts of her life yet. Problem was, she didn't suffer any illusions about her ability to, as he'd so succinctly put it, see death coming. She was a college student, an archaeology major at that. People were not her forte. Not living ones, anyway. She was no slouch with the dead ones, like the Iceman or the Bog People. But that wouldn't get her very far with an assassin. Sad fact was, death could probably stalk up to her wearing a hooded black robe and toting a scythe, and she'd get all distracted wondering about the age, origin, and composition of the scythe. Ergo, like it or not, and dear God, she didn't. She needed him. Whatever he was. The professor was dead. The deliverymen were dead. She'd been next. 3 out of 4 down. She felt like one of those ditzy heroines in a murder mystery. Or one of those fluffy romance novels, the loose end that needed tidying up. The one the psychopath kept coming after. The helpless girly girl. And she'd never considered herself helpless in her entire life. Girly, maybe, but not helpless. Now, standing outside the door to Professor Keene's office yet again, she stiffened her spine, mentally preparing to fling herself upon an impossible being's mercy. Either he would protect her as he claimed, or he really was some cosmically evil villain, justly imprisoned and lying through his teeth, who planned to kill her, the way things had been going for her lately, gruesomely, and with much blood, right there on the spot. If that was the case, she was damned if she did, and damned if she didn't. Her demise a mere bit of squabbling over place and time, so she should probably just buck up and get it over with. She glanced at her watch. 12:42 a.m. Goodbye, life as she knew it. Hello, chaos. Hopefully, not just goodbye, life. She pushed open the door and stepped into the office.
Okay,
she told the silvery surface with a sigh.
I think we can make a deal.
He was there before she'd even fully formed the word think. She finished the rest of the sentence a bit breathlessly. A slow, exultant smile curved his lips.
Deal, my bollocks. Get me the bloody hell out of here, woman. Don't give me excuses, Lucan snarled into the phone. Roman is dead. I need Eve in Chicago now.
He rose and stood before the tall windows of his study, staring out at the London dawn as the first faint streaks of sun burned off the fog. The sky beyond was still dim enough that he could also see his own reflection superimposed on the tinted glass. Alone, he did not bother with a spell to conceal his appearance. His entire skull was a miasma of crimson and black runes. His tongue flickered black inside his tattooed mouth when he spoke, and his eyes were feral crimson. It was Thursday morning. He had 20 days. He turned his gaze to the darker spot on the silk wallpaper where the dark glass had hung for so long. Kian's captivity had been a constant source of amusement to him. The legendary Keltar, the most powerful of all druids ever known, ensorcelled by one Lucan Merthyn Trevane. His hands fisted, his jaw clenched. That empty spot would be filled again, and soon. Returning his attention to the conversation, he snapped.
The St. James woman knows she's in danger now. There's no telling what she'll do. I need her taken care of immediately, but first I need that damned mirror back. Roman said it was in the professor's office. Have her ship it to my private residence the moment she arrives, then get rid of the girl and anyone else who's seen it. Damn Roman. The police were asking too many questions, and he suspected at least one or two officers had seen the dark glass, which meant retiring a few members of law enforcement, and those cases never closed. In the past, he'd not denied Roman his preference for strangulation, so long as he went in, disposed of all problems before the police found any bodies, and got out fast, before an investigation was even opened. But he hadn't. He'd failed with the woman and ended up dead himself, which gave Lucan no small amount of pause. How had Roman ended up on the commons with his neck broken? He could think of one man that possessed the deadly strength and skill to snap the Russian's neck as if popping chicken bones, Kian McKelter. And if that were the case, someone had let him out of the mirror. Not good. Not good at all. The only person he could fathom might have done so was the St. James woman. According to Roman, when he'd last checked in, there were 4 people in Chicago who'd seen the dark glass, or
like Dr. Liam Keane, had possessed critical knowledge of it, and Jessica St. James was the final one to be dispatched. Lucan knew well the Keltar had a way with women. His upper lip curled. So much wasted on a primitive mountain man, a Highlander, no less. Not just looks, strength, and charisma, but wild, pure magic. The kind of power Lucan had worked dozens of lifetimes to achieve a mere fraction of, the Kelter had been born with a hundredfold. If the St. James woman had indeed been seduced to the Keltar's bidding, then Lucan was sending Eve to her death. He'd have his answer soon enough. If Eve went missing, he'd know he had a far more serious problem on his hands than he'd thought.
Tell her to put her other contract on hold. I need her now.
A pause. A growl.
I don't believe you have no way of reaching her. Find one. Get her in Chicago today or else.
He listened a moment, holding the phone away from his ear. After a long pause, he said tightly,
I don't think you understand. I want her there now.